This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two grand jury resistors from Portland are released from prison.
The Army denies a request for information on its policies towards post-traumatic stress disorder.
And Army whistleblower Bradley Manning pleads guilty to minor charges against him and testifies before a military judge.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 28th, 2013. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Andrew Geller. Two Portland activists have been released from prison in Seattle after serving 5 months in solitary confinement for refusing to testify before a federal grand jury. Matt Duran and Katio Olesnik were sent to prison in September, along with Maddie Pfeiffer, who is still in prison, and Leah Lynn Plant, who was released after serving 1 week in prison and then appearing before the grand jury. Under the law, imprisonment for civil contempt is not supposed to punish witnesses, but coerce them into testifying. Christian Williams is a member of the Committee Against Political Repression, which was organized to support the grand jury resistors.
They were called as witnesses before a federal grand jury investigating the anarchist movement. They refused to answer questions about other people's political affiliations or political beliefs. And as a result of that, they were put in prison on the theory that they would stay there until they decided to talk. And Judge Jones's decision of yesterday admits that that was a failed attempt and that no amount of keeping them in prison was going to break their resolve. There was an affidavit, a search warrant, that was unsealed dating from October of last year. One of the things that that affidavit makes clear is that they are looking not so much for evidence of particular people involved in particular crimes, but more broadly at the anarchist movement in general. I mean, it talks about the need to identify not only conspirators in the case, meaning people who participated in the demonstration on May 1st, but also their associates, meaning people who are associated with people who participated in that demonstration, but are not themselves suspected of anything. So the evidence that the entire investigation amounts to a political witch hunt is building with every new piece of information that comes out. It's inherently cruel to lock people away and isolate them from their communities, pull them out of their lives, and it's especially cruel to then further isolate them within the prison and remove them from any normal human contact or external sources of information. And the both of them spent considerable amounts of time in solitary while they were locked up. It's torture. There's no other word for it.
That was Christian Williams with the Committee Against Political Repression speaking about two grand jury resistors, Matt Duran and Katio Olesnik, who were released from prison in Seattle earlier today.
A group of mental health activists held a rally in Vancouver today to challenge the city's practice of jailing people suffering from mental illness. Cindy Fisher, who helped organize the rally, spoke with KBOO today about what she and other organizers hope to accomplish.
What it was about was emphasizing there's a better way. It's like we want to reclaim mental health diversity and honor the diversity of people's mental health, that we exist on a spectrum of human emotions that go from deep depression to ecstatic joy, and that when we are in the down part of our human emotion, we don't have to turn our loved ones or ourselves over to the pharmaceutical and psychiatric industry, because their power has been perverted. Their answer to everything is a pill for our pain. The pill itself, we find for many, many people, is very harmful, can create other diseases, can create disability itself. And people who are on psychiatric medications long-term actually have a lifespan that's 25 years shorter on the average than other people. We met in front of the courthouse because the jail behind the courthouse is actually the new place where people that experience mental health diversity or often people say mental health illness, they are warehouse jail, often treated in very inhumane ways that violate actually the international human rights laws, kept in isolation, strapped down into chairs. And consequently, we have a very high attempted suicide rate in our jail compared to other jails. Last year, we had 18 attempted suicides. And we also had the death of a young man who the guards said they were trying to keep him from committing suicide, and they killed him. Asphyxiation, and the guards holding him down. So we say there's a better way. We want to create community where the hearts can heal. We want to have the alternatives in the community so that there's no such thing as a psychiatric lockup. Sure. Taking someone who is struggling with the life challenges, whatever symptoms they have, taking away their freedom, locking them up, and in some cases, because I advocate for mothers around the country, in many cases, in many hospitals, including our Western State Hospital, you have to earn the right for basic human rights, like breathing fresh air. If you don't get to level 2 or level 3, you don't get to go outside for an extended period of time just to breathe fresh air, you know? You are sometimes at the mercy or at the whim of the doctors. If you've got a medication that you feel like is making you dizzy, making you sick, making your head swell, you're silent. Yeah. You don't have a voice. Right. Not only are you locked up, your voice is locked out, and those who care for you and want to be your allies are often locked out of the picture. The system is set up so that when there's not help, let's say someone has a psychosis and there's not help, they will get worse, and to the point that the public will say, please, or the loved one that's concerned about their person having a psychosis, please take them to the hospital. Please force drug them. And what we want people to know is what happens behind the locked doors, because then they will join us in creating alternatives like open dialogue. I want to say we had the rally today because it's my son's birthday, and he's been in the hospital for over a year. When he first went in, I begged, I pleaded, I rallied in the courthouse a year ago to say, please give him trauma-informed, culturally sensitive care. They spent over $250,000, $584 a day plus doctor and prescription charges in this last year, and they haven't dealt with any of the traumas that are recorded that have been in his record for almost 17 years. They always give him maximum, double the maximum doses of drugs. He hates being there. He says it's always about shame or blame, and I want that changed. I want us to have trauma-informed care in the community, and the communities become places where the hearts can heal.
That was Cindy Fisher, who helped organize a rally in Vancouver, Washington today for mental health diversity. The group hopes to convince state officials to change their policy of sending people with mental illness to state and local jails.
A 5.1 magnitude earthquake occurred yesterday afternoon at 2:25, about 100 miles west of Port Orford in the Pacific Ocean. The quake occurred at a depth of approximately 6.1 miles along the western edge of the Juan de Fuqua Plate. Weak tremors were felt southwest of Salem and along the coast, but no damage was reported. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center has not released any warnings related to the quake. This is the most powerful earthquake to hit the region since a 5.3 magnitude quake on January 30th, which occurred just north of yesterday's event.
Several of Oregon's southwestern timber counties are going broke, and state legislators are scrambling to provide essential services. Federal payments, originally intended to compensate for the decline in logging activity, have formed the backbone of these counties' budgets. The federal money is being phased out, and the area has a small tax base due to large swaths of federal forest land and traditionally low property taxes. As a result, counties are unable to cover the costs of basic services like elections, tax collection, and public safety. In Josephine County, for example, the rejection of a property tax levy for law enforcement in 2012 forced the sheriff to cut his deputies down to 6, release inmates from county jails, and close the major crimes unit. A large number of bills offering solutions are going before the state legislature, all of which involve the state filling in the blanks in county budgets. One bill would permit the counties to declare bankruptcy, a last resort which is currently illegal. Others involve schemes to have the state take over necessary county services, but there are concerns about the ability of the counties to repay the cost anytime soon. No matter what course lawmakers take, the problems of these heavily forested, sparsely populated counties have become statewide problems.
In the city of Portland, there are about 910 acres of brownfields, or land contaminated by previous industrial or commercial use. While these sites are mostly found in industrial areas, they do exist in almost every Portland neighborhood. A recent memo sent to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability by its economic planner, Tyler Bump, calls on city planners to create incentives to encourage the remediation and redevelopment of these sites. Bump estimates that redevelopment of all of Portland's brownfields could generate $1.4 billion spread across over 30,000 jobs, especially if the brownfields in and around the downtown area are cleaned and developed. However, these developments will likely require proactive and wide-ranging incentives from the city, since brownfield cleanups tend to be prohibitively expensive for the small businesses that own many of the sites. Redevelopment projects like this have occurred in Portland before, such as the South Waterfront area, but never on a citywide scale.
Governor John Kitzhaber told Oregonians for the first time last week about his plan to create a Department of Post-Secondary Education. He would be consolidating power over the state's public universities, community colleges, scholarship programs, and Oregon Health and Science University, eliminating several state agencies in the process. If the plan goes forward, Kitzhaber will have appointed the most important positions in charge of all the main sectors of Oregon public education, from kindergarten through graduate school. The proposed post-secondary education department will control funding for public undergraduate and graduate school programs in the state. Ideally, it would funnel support to successful programs that produce the most and best graduates, instead of the current model, which issues funds on a per-student basis. The department would focus on efficiency in hopes of meeting the state's goal of having 40% of Oregonians possess a post-secondary degree by the year 2025. In related news, Oregon Health and Science University has instituted a hiring freeze in anticipation of looming federal cuts due to partisan gridlock in Congress. The institution will lose around $7 million from cuts to Medicare reimbursements, but the education and research programs will bear the brunt of the hiring freeze, as well as other cuts in order to preserve the institution's various hospitals and clinics.
Local solar manufacturer SoloPower started manufacturing solar panels at its Portland facility last fall. But the company announced today that it plans to cut its workforce as part of a restructuring plan. When it opened its $340 million facility in Portland last September, the California-based startup planned to employ hundreds of Oregon workers to manufacture lightweight solar panels. The company received millions of dollars in loan guarantees and incentives from both Oregon and the federal government. Oregon and Portland approved nearly $58 million in loans, tax credits, and other tax breaks to encourage the company to locate its first factory in the state. Though SoloPower did not detail the size or location of the layoffs, it did confirm the job cuts will help the company lower costs as it transitions from a research to a manufacturing focus.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be drizzly in the morning and otherwise mostly cloudy, with a high near 62 degrees. Tomorrow night we'll see continued clouds, patchy fog after 10 p.m., and lows dropping to 44 degrees.
It's 5:17 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Sometimes the cost of winning is so great that you really lose. This little lesson seems to be dawning on several food industry powers. Such huge processors and retailers as ConAgra, PepsiCo, Unilever, and Walmart dumped millions of dollars into last November's monumental labeling battle over California's Proposition 37, which would have required corporations to tell consumers if any of their food products contain ingredients with genetically manipulated DNA. Using piles of political cash, deceptive advertising, and outright lies, the corporate Goliaths squeaked out a narrow victory over a scrappy coalition of consumers, environmentalists, organic producers, and others. But while big money won the election, the corporations lost the hearts and minds of their own customers. For they exposed themselves as greed heads, going to extremes to deny people's right to know what they're putting into their own bodies and into their children's bodies. That's not a winning proposition over the long haul, no matter how much political money they throw at it. Moreover, far from feeling defeated, the pro-labeling coalition was energized by having flushed out of hiding the big brand names that are secretly putting GMO contaminants in our food supply. Having awakened public consciousness, the grassroots coalition has flummoxed the genetic manipulators by not going away. Instead, it has already expanded the political fight for honesty and food purity into Connecticut, Missouri, New Mexico, Vermont, and Washington State. This is Jim Hightower saying, and now the strength of the issue and tenacity of the coalition has pushed a couple of dozen major food peddlers, including PepsiCo and Walmart, to begin talking about switching sides and supporting a national labeling law. To keep up and help push, go to www.organicconsumers.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Three regional news organizations have been denied a Freedom of Information request and subsequent appeals. The journalists were trying to obtain a copy of an Army report that may explain the Army's policy towards post-traumatic stress disorder. More than 400 military personnel seeking services at Madigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington, were reassessed and identified as suffering from other conditions. But after the investigation, 150 patients saw a return to the original diagnosis of PTSD. One of the reporters that filed the FOIA request is Patricia Murphy of KUOW Public Radio in Seattle. She spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about the station's struggle to get information from the Army about this issue.
How and when did this story first come to your attention?
Well, this story actually was broke by the Seattle Times. A great reporter over there by the name of Hal Burton got a hold of a memo that quoted a psychiatrist's presentation about medical retirements and PTSD diagnoses. And basically the gist of the presentation was that a soldier retired with a PTSD diagnosis would collect $1.5 million in disability payments over his or her lifetime. And his presentation warned his colleagues against rubber stamping a PTSD diagnosis. And that was in September 2011 that the presentation was made. The story came to light after that sometime.
So when did you file your first request under FOIA regarding the matter?
I think we filed our first FOIA in this story in August. People had been removed from their jobs pending the investigation. So it was definitely in the public's interest and our interest to file those FOIAs to find out what was going on at Madigan.
And what were the reasons offered as grounds to deny your requests?
The first request was denied because they said it was pre-decisional. There was an Army-wide investigation that had been ordered, and it was too soon to release those documents. However, we appealed that by saying on the grounds that, in fact, they had made many decisions based on this information that they had gotten from the investigation, and that it was, again, in the public's interest to understand what had happened at Madigan. And time went by and time went by, and shortly before the Army Secretary's press conference, we had talked about bringing it up with him, the FOIA requests that had been unfulfilled at that point. So the reporters in the room who had filed FOIAs, I believe it was Hal who brought it up with the Army Secretary, John McHugh. His question was, you know, we are waiting on these FOIA requests. When do you think they might come out? What can you tell us about them? And at the time, McHugh had said he was unfamiliar with our FOIA requests and that he was prepared at some point to release the National Behavioral Health Review, the Army-wide Behavioral Health Review, but it wasn't going to be that day. It was about 2 days, I think, after that, that the first denials came in, and the first ones came into the Tacoma News Tribune, and then Hal, and then myself. So we had all been denied.
Any feel for how many soldiers have undergone this process or had their diagnosis changed?
Well, the 431 cases at Madigan that went to be reviewed at Walter Reed, some of those diagnoses did not return to post-traumatic stress. They got other diagnoses like anxiety disorder. But some of them were returned to PTSD, 150 of them, I think, was the number, actually. So a significant number. I mean, if you consider 431 cases being overturned and 150 being reinstated, that is significant. Those 150 people, real people.
So what's the next step for you in terms of obtaining information?
The only thing we can do at this point is hire attorneys and take the Department of Defense to court. I don't know if anybody is prepared to do that just yet. I think we're still waiting to see the results of the Army-wide Behavioral Health Review and see what's in there that may help us understand a little bit more. And we're also hoping that Senator Patty Murray, the senior senator here in Washington State, who is equally concerned about this, can somehow prod the DOD to release more information about what happened. I think it's always in the best interest of the public to understand how their tax dollars are being spent, and that's really what's going on here. How much money did the Army invest in this behavioral-wide health review? How much money did they invest in doing AR-15-6 investigations at Madigan? If the bottom line was really the reason they were reversing these diagnoses, we've certainly spent an awful lot to try to prove that, you know, what they were doing there was either right or wrong.
For folks who might hear what we're talking about today and want to get involved and help,
call your congressman, you know, write your newspapers and write an editorial. And if you know anybody who's been through something like that, tell them to talk about it. The Army Secretary did not tell us at his press conference that he wouldn't release those FOIA results. That was an inaccuracy in the NBC article. So,
Patricia Murphy, thanks for your time and keep up the good work. This is Robin Ryan for KBOO News.
U.S. Army Private Bradley Manning, imprisoned for over 1,000 days due to accusations of his leaking a massive trove of confidential government documents and information to the website WikiLeaks, filed pleas today on the charges against him. KBOO reporter Jen Chavez filed this report.
In an appearance before a military judge today, Army whistleblower Private Bradley Manning filed guilty pleas on some of the lesser charges against him for his release of classified U.S. military and diplomatic documents to the website WikiLeaks in 2010. He pled guilty before a judge on 10 minor charges, including possession of the classified information and disclosure of the information to an unauthorized party, or misuse of the information. Those charges can carry a maximum sentence of 20 years. He pled not guilty to the more serious charge against him, aiding the enemy, and other charges of violation of the Espionage Act, which, if convicted of, could land him in prison for life. In the testimony that followed, which lasted over an hour, he explained some of his reasoning behind the leak. Kevin Gastola, a journalist who's been covering the Manning case for Fire Dog Lake, was there.
What was happening today, the reason why you could get some insight into what Manning was thinking, is because he was essentially giving background and facts around what led to him committing the offenses, and that was allowed by the judge. It was voluntarily done. The judge didn't require him to do the statement, but he typed up a 35-page statement that he had written while in confinement at Fort Leavenworth and then read it in the courtroom today.
Manning described how he obtained the documents. Initially, he was solely using them for work reasons, and his decision that, quote, if the public, in particular the American public, had access to the information, this could spark a debate about foreign policy in relation to Iraq and Afghanistan, end quote. He also described carefully planning out which documents to release and which not to, based on their potential to do real harm to the U.S. This is the first time Manning has discussed his motivations or reasoning in his court-martial proceedings.
Well, I think the more notable aspects were his descriptions of the video of the Apache helicopter attack in Iraq in 2007. He basically was talking about how he was really bothered by the way that the air weapons team in the video is talking, he described it as it was like a child putting a magnifying glass over an ant and trying to fry it with the sun, because he was saying that there was a person in this video that's wounded and is trying to get away, and instead of getting medical attention, they talk about how he should pick up a weapon so that they could fire at him. The other thing that I would just mention is striking was that he was saying he called the Washington Post, he called the New York Times, and wanted to provide war logs from Iraq and Afghanistan, those public releases. He didn't go to WikiLeaks first. He wanted to involve the U.S. press.
The proceedings are leading up to the beginning of Manning's trial, scheduled for June 3rd. Kevin Gastola explains the next steps for the prosecution following Manning's pleas.
The government intends to go forward and try to prove the original charges. The government maintains he is still guilty of everything that they charged him with. In sentencing, she's going to decide, is he guilty of the major misconduct or just these lesser offenses of which he says he's guilty?
Manning has gained a following of anti-war, whistleblowing, and anti-secrecy activists, typified by the prominent Bradley Manning Support Network, which can be found at bradleymanning.org. Kevin Gastola says supporters of Manning might also be interested in coverage by his publication.
Personally, that as a journalist with Fire Dog Lake, we've taken particular interest in the aiding the enemy charge, and there's a petition at our website to send a message to the court-martial convening authority and ask that the aiding the enemy charge be dropped, because we view this as a threat to freedom of the press.
This has been Jen Chavez reporting for KABU News. A group of Oregon soldiers is watching a Maryland court case against military contractor Kellogg Brown and Root, or KBR, with some trepidation, as it may set a precedent for a similar court case here. A judge in Maryland ruled yesterday that KBR is not responsible for exposing soldiers to hazardous fumes during a cleanup operation in Iraq. This decision may set a precedent for an Oregon case in which a dozen National Guardsmen sued KBR for exposing them to chemical toxins while cleaning up the Karmat Ali water treatment plant. A judge ruled in favor of the soldiers in November, awarding them a total of $85 million in damages, but did not formally issue a judgment in the case. Just this week, the lawyers for KBR filed a motion challenging that ruling. The judge in the Maryland case argued that civilian courts should not step in on military issues and that it would be against the national interest for him to convict the company. KBR is a publicly traded company and former subsidiary of Halliburton that profits heavily from contracts with the U.S. military. The company has been involved in multiple scandals, including pleading guilty to violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act for paying tens of millions of dollars in bribes. KBR has also been charged with safety violations that cost soldiers lives, taking no-bid contracts from the Bush administration, engaging in human trafficking, and sexual misconduct.
In December 2007, John Kiriakou, a CIA veteran who directed counterterrorism operations in Pakistan after 9/11, exposed the CIA's torture program in an interview with ABC News. Today, Kiriakou began a 30-month prison term after pleading guilty to one count of violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. In exchange, prosecutors dropped all other charges, including charges that he violated the Espionage Act. KABU reporter Joe Lino spoke with Jesselyn Radak, Kiriakou's attorney and National Security and Human Rights Director for the Government Accountability Project, for more on this story.
It's been reported that during his tenure in counterterrorism operations in Pakistan, that John Kiriakou refused to be trained in torture interrogation tactics. What do you feel the fact that someone who exposed the CIA's torture program is going to jail, while those who actually did the torturing are not, says about the U.S. government's attitude towards whistleblowing in general?
Well, I think the U.S. has a horrible attitude towards whistleblowing, and the fact that the only CIA officer to go to jail in connection with the torture program is John Kiriakou, and he didn't torture anybody. He exposed that we had a torture program. He called waterboarding torture, and he explained that it was an official program and not a few rogue agents. So I find it particularly abhorrent that he's the one going to jail, and meanwhile, people who did torture, people who ordered torture, people who justified torture, and people who destroyed the videotapes of it are getting book deals in Hollywood movies, and John's going to be in jail.
Do you expect anyone involved with the actual torturing to ever face trial?
I do not expect anyone involved with the torturing to ever face trial, at least not in the U.S. A number of CIA agents have been found guilty in absentia by the Italian court. And I think other human rights courts in other countries may find some of them guilty, but I don't expect anywhere in the U.S. to find them guilty.
Kiriakou exposed the CIA's torture policy in 2007. What kind of support, if any, has Kiriakou received during this whole ordeal?
Not